We know by now that Wittgenstein was indeed very familiar with Kierkegaard's writings. And what I'm particularly interested in is that in his diary of the beginning of the 1930s, he comments extensively on Kierkegaardian points, especially Kierkegaard's view of religion and of philosophical method. Wittgenstein also enters some remarks regarding Kierkegaard's view of love, something that may be prompted, if we allow ourselves a moment of speculation, by concurrent reflection on his relationship with Margarete Respinger. However, these reflections, even if prompted by personal considerations, are worked into Wittgenstein's philosophical thoughts, in this case, his reflection on philosophical method. The main aim of the paper is to show that Wittgenstein's reflection on Kierkegaard's view of love reveals a fundamental difference between the two thinkers with regard to their view of philosophical method. The intent is not to challenge the standard conception according to which there are substantial similarities between Kierkegaard and Wittgenstein's views, but to develop this conception by showing where these similarities end. The difference between the two thinkers concern their view of the role of the partner or reader, partner in philosophy or reader of philosophy, a difference I think is often overlooked, or if noted, explicitly rejected in the relevant commentary. The paper falls into five sections. In the first, we'll draw up what is meant to be a rather uncontroversial sketch of similarities between Wittgenstein and Kierkegaard's view of philosophy. In the second section, we return to an account of Kierkegaard's view of love and marriage in order to understand the background for Wittgenstein's reservations. These will be presented in section 3. In section 4, we will discuss how the difference between Kierkegaard and Wittgenstein's views on love connect to what we will here claim is a fundamental difference between their views on philosophy. This, the main discussion of the paper, will be presented in section 4 and will be supplemented with a few points advanced by Stanley Cavell in his work on the so-called Hollywood remarriage comedies. So first, similarities. In Wittgenstein's remarks from the 30s, we find the following characterization of Kierkegaard's philosophy. On Kierkegaard, I would present a life for you and now see how you relate to it, whether it tempts, urges you to live like that as well, or what other relation to it you attain. Through this representation, I would like to, as it were, loosen up your life. Obviously, what Wittgenstein finds important in Kierkegaard's philosophy are not particularly doctrines or information presented, but Kierkegaard's aim to influence his readers through their engagement with his texts. This, of course, marks a noteworthy connection between the philosophical method of Kierkegaard and that of Wittgenstein, something highlighted by many of those who have already compared the philosophical style and aim of the two writers. In this context, we will allow ourselves to focus more or less exclusively on three similarities, and again, as far as this goes, similarities about which there are quite substantial agreement in the commentary. The first feature is the noted rejection of the idea that the main task of philosophy is to solve problems by presenting us with particular doctrines. And Wittgenstein and Kierkegaard's mutual adherence to the alternative idea that philosophical activity concerns the way we state, address, and try to solve such, and we state and address such problems. We find that Wittgenstein insisting that philosophy does not advance theses, but is the activity of assembling reminders for a particular purpose, of setting up objects of comparison. In a slightly more humble tone, Wittgenstein's main representative of a philosopher, the pseudonym concluding unscientific postscript, Johannes Climacus, distinguishes between two different forms of philosophy. The first is objective philosophy, aka Hegelianism, concerned with matters about which we can have an exchange of objective knowledge. And the second, and the form that Climacus is trying himself to exemplify, is a simpler philosophy concerned with human existence and that is responsive to its particular shape, that is, to existence as a possible state of becoming. This simpler philosophy, Climacus insists, is primarily concerned not with the what of some particular content, but with the how of a particular saying of a content. And it does thus have to go through indirect communication. That's for both Wittgenstein and Kierkegaard. The form philosophical text have becomes integral to their purpose, as the aim of the text is to facilitate a discovery rather than to deliver a result. The second similarity, and the reason why both thinkers focus on process rather than result, on form rather than content, is that their writings are essentially aimed at a reader. We find this reflected when Kierkegaard directly addresses his reader, his listener, or in Danish, hin enkelte, that individual who is the relevant addressee of his writings. And we find it reflected in the dialogical form of Wittgenstein's later writings, in his continuous engagement with, an interlocutor, but several, and even maybe changing interlocutors in his text. More than anything, I think this is the feature that distinguishes the writing of Wittgenstein and Kierkegaard, and their explicit intention to engage the reader and to take as their starting point the perspective of that reader. And I also think this marks the point where they part company with almost all other philosophers, actually, including the present. Thirdly, both Kierkegaard and Wittgenstein think that the main aim of philosophy is to spur the reader to a form of change. Thus, philosophical reflections ought to awaken and provoke men, and to be a gadfly, Kierkegaard writes, or as Wittgenstein phrases it, the aim of philosophy is to overcome, is to overcome the contrast between the understanding of the subject and what most people want to see, to overcome a resistance of the will. Philosophical reflection should facilitate particular possibilities for the reader, from a change of perspective to a change of life. As Genia Schönbaumsfeld puts it, Kierkegaard and Wittgenstein both want the reader to do something. And she quotes Wittgenstein for saying, "I don't try to make you believe something you don't believe, but to make you do something you won't do." Moreover, as this aim of philosophy is essentially practical and concerns the reader's way of thinking and living, the activity of philosophy has an inescapable ethical dimension. Well, the present talk is concerned with the ways that Kierkegaard and Wittgenstein understand and realize their engagement with the reader. The guiding idea, or the thesis that I want to advance, is that we here find two quite different forms of engagement. However, before we turn to this, actually, we won't turn to this in quite a while, even if it is the main project of the talk, I want to say something first about how this project relates to what is often presented as the main connection between Wittgenstein and Kierkegaard's views of philosophy. Often it's noted that what connects them is the similarity between the Tractarian notions of what can be said and what can only be shown on the one hand, and Climacus, or Kierkegaard's notions of direct and indirect communication on the other. This parallel invites the idea that the philosophical methods of both Wittgenstein and Kierkegaard are necessitated by a need to communicate something that indeed cannot be said. This is the viewpoint of more traditional readings, or necessitated by the aim to expose an urge to communicate something that is incoherent and thus collapses into nonsense in more recent readings. However, the perspective of this talk is rather different. Here the aim is not to consider the question of what can and cannot be communicated or what we can come to want to communicate. Instead, the central question is the question of how to do something, how to initiate philosophical engagement and change in the reader. Thus, the focus on philosophy is as philosophy as essentially practical. So, I'll just skip. Moreover, to get beyond the Tractarian difference between the difference what can be said and what can only be shown, the focus of the following will be the similarities and differences between Kierkegaard's view of philosophy and the view of philosophy developed by Wittgenstein from his return to philosophy in the 1929 onto the philosophical investigation. Okay. The subject of our investigation is thus the different forms of engagement with the reader exemplified in Wittgenstein and Kierkegaard's writings. In the remarks I mentioned at the beginning, Wittgenstein explicitly reflects on the form of engagement exemplified in Kierkegaard's writings. But as these reflections are tied to considerations concerning Kierkegaard's view of love, we need to sketch this view first. In passing, we should note that the reflection on love run through almost all of Kierkegaard's writings, indicating that they, for Kierkegaard, are a central turning point of his philosophical project. So let us begin by looking at some of the lives that Wittgenstein finds presented in Kierkegaard's philosophy. One such life is that of Judge Wilhelm, the alleged author of the second part of Either Or, another that of Wilhelm's addressee, the higher aesthete A, and at the end of the section we will add the character of Kierkegaard himself. Judge Wilhelm is known as Kierkegaard's representative of the ethical, but he is also a character concerned with marriage and love, and his consideration is directed at A in his particular perspective. What Wilhelm wants A to see is that he, as any human being, is placed before a fundamental question, the question, I quote, the question under which one will view all existence and personally live. According to Wilhelm, this is the choice freely to acknowledge both the real and the potential self that one is, to choose the absolute validity, but the absolute validity of this particular self. However, A continuously retreats from this question. When A reflects on his existence, he sees a number of interesting possibilities for experiences, new friendships, erotic relationships. But he also notes that none of these present themselves as having any special weight or importance. He therefore concludes that the raison d'etre of his life is to realize as many possibilities as he can, and to do so in a way that does not prevent him from realizing other possibilities. To succeed with this project, A strives to live out extraordinary experiences while avoiding all forms of obligations. And we find a paradigmatic example of this in his love story as described in The Seducer's Diary. This also reveals a number of A's central concerns. First, for the realization of a possibility to be worthwhile for A, it has to be extraordinary in some way or other. And the object of desire in The Seducer's Diary, Cordelia, isn't indeed a particularly desirable young woman. She's clever and smart and innocent and interesting and all these things. Secondly, A's aim is to realize romantic love with all its depth, without this relationship being tainted by other more mundane elements such as plans for the future or wedding vows. And finally, and this is of vital importance for A, the relationship at the realization of the sublime moment of love should be broken off so that it does not give rise to obligations that would otherwise obstruct A's freedom. In response to this, Wilhelm gives another account of love that I find that we need in order to understand Wittgenstein's reflections. Wilhelm insists that A's resistance against tainting romantic love with thoughts of marriage arises from a failure to understand that love, from its very initiation, involves more than a spontaneous sublime moment. Even if love arises momentarily, it's a moment that manifests something eternal. The extraordinary feature of love is that it seems as if it's always have and always will be. By being connected to eternity, romantic love that raises a demand that love itself cannot meet. With love comes a demand for permanence that cannot be provided by reflection. We find this in the story of A. He reflects a lot, but cannot hold on to anything. It can only be provided ethically and religiously, Wilhelm would say, in duty and in a relationship with God. At this point, A will restate his objection that duty and faith are incompatible with free, spontaneous love. But Wilhelm does not yield. What does duty demand with regard to love? Duty demands nothing beyond that I love the other. However, in loving not just as a reaction to spontaneous love, but as a response to the call of duty, I do more than just love. I make my love for the other an object of my own will. We found a similar structure with regard to the religious. If the lovers are, as Wilhelm phrases it, religiously developed, they will refer to God in a thanksgiving for the love that is given them. This does not alter love, but it also the lovers, because their love becomes rooted in the action of thankfulness. The ethical and the religious moment thus introduce an element and will of will and action into love, a decision that provides love with durability. Through this decision, the lovers show that they understand the happiness of love as a continuous task, and that task is providing the possibility of happiness. Such decisions do, however, need a frame, Wilhelm insists, and this is marriage. Only marriage makes possible the Shakespearean notorious description that love is not love which alters when alteration finds. And marriage is thus a paradigmatic example of how the fundamental task of existence, according to Wilhelm, the task to become this not very particular self that one is, can be realized. Until now, we have focused on the view of love and marriage as presented by Eyre and by Judge Wilhelm. As with all of Kierkegaard's pseudonyms, we should expect Wilhelm to present a particular perspective, one that brings with it certain insights, but also have certain limitations. To get clearer of the strengths and limitations of Wilhelm's perspective, we could try to compare it with that of Kierkegaard, and thus turn to the treatment of love in the Nonsedanerne's Works of Love. Okay. That's a hard word when you're Dane. Sorry. Here, Kierkegaard maintains, as does Wilhelm, that love is the highest joy of earthly life. However, Kierkegaard always also raises the question of the relationship between romantic love and religious love, the love of one's neighbor. He notes that as romantic love is love of this particular person, it is a form of pre-love, forkærlighed in Danish, which also in Danish means preference. Romantic love, Kierkegaard insists, rests on preferences, and in this way it is a form of self-love. It's a love of what you yourself want to love. In contrast, the love of one's neighbor, in the love of one's neighbor, we reject anything contingent, and we thus let go of any form of preferences. It is heavily debated within Kierkegaard scholarships whether Kierkegaard, by identifying romantic love with self-love, devaluates the value of romantic love. I think the most promising answer to this question is complicated. First, we should note that Kierkegaard distinguishes between two different forms of self-love, proper self-love and selfish self-love. And only selfish self-love is illegitimate. That is, self-love does have a proper form, namely to love one's neighbor and thereby to love God, as if there were no distance between oneself, one's neighbor, one's God. You can love yourself as you love your neighbor, as you love God. In that sense, self-love is a proper. This may lead us to suspect that Kierkegaard does not ascribe any value to romantic love. However, a second important observation is that Kierkegaard points to the possibilities that lover may root their mutual love in neighbor love. He writes, "No, love the beloved faithfully and devotedly, but let the love for the neighbor be the sanctifying element in your union's covenant with God." As subject to the love of the neighbor, love and marriage will exemplify proper self-love. However, and this is the last complication, how do we root romantic love in the love of our neighbor? Neighbor love is, as we saw, to love one's neighbor as oneself. Kierkegaard takes this quite literally. The aim of neighbor love is not to love one's neighbor as a particular contingent other, but to love her as potential self. That is, in neighbor love, we love not the particulars of another person, but her universal potential, her absolute validity, herself, or her potential for being herself. Neighbor love does not acknowledge human categories. To make neighbor love the sanctifying element in one's relationship, in one's marriage, or one's love, thus have to involve the attempt not to disregard, but to see beyond the individuality of one's spouse and to attempt to love him or her as one may love all others because of a common potential for becoming a self. Only in this form, as neighbor love, is love eternally secure against every change, Kierkegaard writes. The way that Kierkegaard understands the relationship between romantic love and love of one's neighbor raises a problem for Wilhelm and his account of marriage. Wilhelm wills the particular love of his particular wife. He loves her moderation, her devotion, her lullabies, that to Wilhelm is more beautiful than any other song. We can make a large, huge digression on Wilhelm's way of describing his wife, which is sadly comical, but we will leave that out now. But what the point is that Wilhelm's love is preferential, and thus in this way, he is faithful to his description of love as the realization of something universal through something particular, through a particular love. However, this insistence on the particular also proves an obstacle for the movement towards the love of one's neighbor, demanded of faith. Thus, it appears as if Wilhelm is incapable of grasping religious love. And thus, it appears as if Kierkegaard, in portraying Wilhelm, is presenting us with a possible and appealing view of love that Wilhelm, but one that Kierkegaard does, in an important sense, see as wanting. So, this is Kierkegaard's complaint against Wilhelm, but as we should see, it's not Wittgenstein's. However, before we turn to Wittgenstein's critique, we should consider the positive influence of Kierkegaard's writings in the diaries of the early 30s. One such influence is the consideration that one cannot rest one's life on particular occurrences, not even those of love. Wittgenstein writes, "Have reason to suppose that my reader does not particularly care for me. One voice in me says, 'Then it's over, you must lose heart.' Then another one says, 'Then that must not get you down, you have to anticipate it, and your life cannot be founded upon the occurrence of some even greatly desired case.'" Wittgenstein's admonition of himself paralyzed the point that Wilhelm raises with address to A, namely that we cannot be free, cannot be a self if we let our existence be utterly dependent on outer occurrences, even such a precious occurrence as the love of another person. We have to live in a way, Wilhelm would say, that springs from an acknowledgement, or in his vocabulary, a choice of ourselves and of our circumstances, no matter how discouraging. Wittgenstein continues this line of thought. Someone who cannot entrust what he loves into the hands of the gods, but wants to keep tinkering with it himself, does not have the right love for it after all. For this is the severity which is supposed to be part of love. Wittgenstein seems to be struggling to accept that love as it presents itself to him. That is, he's trying to accept that love is not something that he can secure or alter, but a gift that may or may not be granted him, and that may be granted in a form different from what he had hoped or expected. And we find this actually in quite a few remarks, another one which is from a much later date. We may, however, want to ascribe the influences present here to Wilhelm rather than to Kierkegaard. First of all, there's a strikingly un-Kierkegaardian reference in the first quote. The phrase, the hands of the gods. This indicates that for Wittgenstein, the most important notions are those of love as a gift, and of trusting what is presented to him, and of receiving love in the right way. That is, notions highlighted by Wilhelm. Wittgenstein is not exploring notions of a more fundamental form of love, or of a particular source of the gift of love, for example, the Christian God, which is for Kierkegaard the more important notions. Moreover, with regard to the noted difference between Wilhelm and Kierkegaard as to whether love essentially involves the acceptance of and gratitude for the loved one's particularity, or involves the striving in love to move beyond such particularities, Wittgenstein clearly takes a stand in favor of Wilhelm, not Kierkegaard. And here's a long quote. "One could say, what you call love for one's neighbor is self-interest. Well, then I don't know any love without self-interest, for I cannot intervene in the eternal salvation of another. I can only say, I want to love him as I, who cares for my soul, wish he would love me. In a certain sense, he cannot want what is eternally best for me. He can only be good to me in a worldly sense and show respect for all that seems to reveal in me a striving for what is highest. When Wittgenstein here writes, one could say he might as well have written Kierkegaard says. Wittgenstein seems to be opposes and actually comes in a longer line of reflections on Kierkegaard. Wittgenstein seems to be opposing a number of elements in Kierkegaard's view of neighbor love. First, he insists that he, Wittgenstein, the one who loves, cannot love the other person's potential for salvation or otherwise, because he is as such not involved in how the other chooses to develop this potential. He can only love the way this potential reveals itself as a striving on behalf of the loved one. Secondly, Wittgenstein insists that as a lover, he should love as he would want to be loved. That is, he should love this particular person, not the person's potential. Love, Wittgenstein insists, I think, isn't ought to be preferential. Something that shows all the stronger because the preferences involved in love often turn out to be other than we thought. So, we might say that Wittgenstein is objecting to Kierkegaard in drawing out a notion of love that transcends all particularity and all preference, is trying to establish a notion where love cannot get a hold, because the other's potential for a higher life, that being ethical or Christian, is not a possible object of love. Well, what could Kierkegaard reply to Wittgenstein? First, he would in fact partly agree with Wittgenstein's point that we cannot intervene in the eternal salvation of the other. Kierkegaard would agree that it is impossible to intervene directly in the other's eternal salvation. However, he actually does think that it's possible to intervene in a very particular sense, namely indirectly, via indirect communication. For Kierkegaard, to love someone as a self, that is neighbor love, is to spur that person to come to care about her eternal salvation. We cannot bring about such incitement directly, simply by telling her, because any sort of relevant change would have to spring from herself. We can, however, bring about incitement indirectly by awakening and provoking her to come to see that she has what Wittgenstein calls a potential for striving for what's highest, and what Kierkegaard simply calls the potential for becoming a self. Neighbor love is thus to awaken the other's awareness of this potential, that is, to open up the possibility of despair. Kierkegaard's word, for this process is to upbuild, to build up, to edify. That is, to relate to the other in a way that presupposes and thereby builds up her potential. His prime example of upbuilding is the way that the loving person in love, and I don't know if I have this one. This is a quote. But the loving person in love signifies that he presupposes love in you and that you are built up by this, that the love in you is built up by this. Thus, through edification, we can, in a very limited sense, Kierkegaard thinks, concern ourselves with the eternal salvation of the other and love her not as a particular person or a particular other, but as a potential self, as our neighbor. This is the two points that Wittgenstein challenges, because he sees in this a neglect of the particular selves that we happen to be. I think these two reservations come together in another, an often quoted remark of Kierkegaard. Okoy Bausma records that Wittgenstein is saying that Kierkegaard is very serious, but continuing that Kierkegaard struck him almost like a snob, too high for him, not touching the details of common life. Take his prayers, they left him unmoved. Okay, what can this call about love have to do with philosophy? Well, quite a lot for both Kierkegaard and for Wittgenstein. In Kierkegaard, the connection is forged by a parallel between the edifying potential of love and the potential of philosophy. The aim undertaken in Kierkegaard's pseudonymous writings, the aim of the simpler subjective philosophy championed by Climacus, is to build up the reader. This is the form that the engagement with the reader takes. However, Climacus insists, in order to edify, the philosopher will have to be reflective, not just of her own perspective or of the perspective of the reader, but of the difference between those two perspectives. In Climacus' words, such a philosopher will have to engage in double reflection. She will have to pay attention to the measured form in relation to the receiver's misunderstanding. What the philosopher cannot do is to reveal this duality, this double reflection, because the very point of our communication is to spur in the reader an awareness of the possibilities that the reader cannot yet appreciate. Thus, there is a secret at the heart of all edification and indirect communication. The ordinary communication of objective thinking has no secrets. It is only the doubly reflective subjective thinking that secrets arise. That is, all of its essential content is essentially secrecy, because it cannot be imparted directly. In order to address the relevant reader, Climacus maintains, the philosopher must keep the secret of the distance between her own perspective and the perspective addressed in her philosophy, that is, the perspective of the reader. This principle runs through most of Kierkegaard's writings. Kierkegaard writes letters, speeches, sermons, manifestos, and the texts are always addressed at someone in particular, the friend, the listener, the reader. His communication does, however, always take the form of an address. It flows only one way. It never becomes a dialogue. In this way, almost all of Kierkegaard's communication is asymmetrical, as are most of the relationship portrayed in his writings. Wilhelm builds up his friend. The loving builds up the loved one. Actually, marriage builds up the married couple. Kierkegaard builds up the reader. But the friend, the loved one, the reader cannot influence the direction or the aim of the process of edification, because edification is directed at an already identified failure on their part. The addressees only contribute to the process by rectifying that failure, by becoming a self, by coming to faith, by trying to love their neighbor. So essential is the idea that we know what the receiver's misunderstanding are, and that this is the aim of the edifying process. In the remarks discussed here, Wittgenstein also sees an intimate connection between an adequate understanding of love and an adequate understanding of philosophical method. If we go back to the critique of Kierkegaard's notion of the unpreferential love, this remark actually follows a longer reflection on the method of Kierkegaard's writing. Wittgenstein's notes. There is something teasing about Kierkegaard's writings, and that is intended, of course, even though I'm not sure whether they're intended to have precisely that effect that they have upon me. There's also no doubt that one teases me, forces me to deal with his concern, and if this concern is important, this is good. And yet, there is something in me that condemns this teasing, and is this only my resentment? Wittgenstein acknowledges that the teasing character of Kierkegaard's writing is intended. Indeed, it seems an integrated part of Kierkegaard's attempt to awaken and provoke his reader. Wittgenstein does, however, also note that Kierkegaard forces him to deal with this concern. That is, he cannot help opposing the way that Kierkegaard's provocation is, at least in part, manipulative. Of course, we should be careful to notice that Wittgenstein does acknowledge that the concern of Kierkegaard as being good. Maybe it is the admiration of this, Wittgenstein's admiration of this aim that motivates his high regard for Kierkegaard as a thinker and a human being, as reflected in the almost infamous remark that, you all know this, Kierkegaard was by far the most profound thinker of the last century. Kierkegaard was a saint. We should, however, also know that Wittgenstein does have serious reservation about this feature of Kierkegaard's thinking, that it has a particular aim. Wittgenstein continues. The idea that someone uses a trick to get me to do something is unpleasant. It is certain that it takes great courage to use this trick, and I would not remotely have this courage. But it is a question whether if I had it, it would be right to use it.
I think that aside from courage, it would also take a lack of love of one's neighbor.
Courage is indeed an often noted ideal of Wittgenstein, as you probably all know. And Kierkegaard's courage in committing to his aims is what, in Wittgenstein's eyes, mark him as being on a different plane from most of us, and what gives him the right to demand something of us. What Wittgenstein is questioning is whether Kierkegaard should make use of this right. It's one thing to earn a right, it's yet another to insist on exercising it. He questions whether Kierkegaard, by exercising this right, shows a lack of love of us, his readers. Kierkegaard is concerned with his reader, not as an actual, particular human being, but as a potential. He tries to love the reader for what she might become, but this means, and this is Wittgenstein's humble point, that he does not actually love the reader as she is. He does not love as I, who cares for my soul, wish he would love me. Wittgenstein reacts to Kierkegaard's aim of deceiving the other into truth, because he thinks that Kierkegaard's exclusive regard for our potentiality devaluates what we actually are and what we actually may contribute, something Wittgenstein finds ethically reproachable. This difference between Kierkegaard and Wittgenstein is reflected in the difference between the ways they do philosophy. Wittgenstein's therapeutic understanding of philosophy necessitate that we begin not from where we think we are or where we think we ought to be, but from where we truly are. And as we noted at the beginning of the talk, Wittgenstein and Kierkegaard thus share the view that philosophical activity must take into account the perspective of the reader and must go all the bloody hard way from there. What is unique in Wittgenstein's way of doing philosophy and what distinguishes it from the method of Kierkegaard is that we here, as in a therapy session, are going anywhere our question may take us. This means that no one, not Wittgenstein, not the therapist, the author, the philosopher, the lover, has any privileged claim with regard to where we're going. As it is an open question whether the reader is just where she ought to be, it is also an open question whether the philosophy is where she ought to be. Here we find no asymmetry. The possibility of getting lost and finding one's way is a privilege open for both philosopher and reader. Or maybe we should all say that here we are all philosophers and we are all potentially lost. In this way, Wittgenstein appears to be far more radical, the far more radical of the two thinkers. Kierkegaard insists that the important thing is philosophy, not the insight it brings about, but the possibilities it offers for changing our lives. But he also insists that this change takes a particular form. In contrast to Wittgenstein, there's no one change, no one road, and for any new investigation, we may end up in a new and yet familiar place. What we have seen is that Wittgenstein has definitive reservations with regard to Kierkegaard's view of neighbor love, edification, both as a conception of love and as a guiding principle for philosophical engagement with the reader. In both cases, Wittgenstein rejects Kierkegaard's view of love in favor of Wilhelm's insisting on the preferential nature of love. This gives rise to one final afterthought, namely, whether Wilhelm's view of love and marriage would serve as a better model for understanding Wittgenstein's philosophical engagement with the reader. The answer to this question, I think we should take it as a no. But to spell out the reason and to offer a better model, we can, just in this final section, we can contrast Wilhelm's view of love and marriage with that presented by Stanley Cavell in his investigation of the classical Hollywood remarriage comedies. Wilhelm highlights a number of features of marriage that accord well with Wittgenstein's view of philosophy. Marriage requires the acceptance of the particularity of the beloved, the question, the reader, and it places you before an unending task. Moreover, the most important aspect of marriage is a matter of will, of coming to will it. We should, however, take note of what it is that Wilhelm wills. According to Wilhelm, the task of marriage is met by willing the absolute through the particular. In this way, the worldly and religious institution of marriage is a precondition of Wilhelm's willing. Thus, there is something that Wilhelm cannot will. Wilhelm cannot will the possibilities that something may change the reality of his relationships, his marriage. He can will being a lover, he can will being a husband, but he cannot will marriage as a mutual relationship, a fellowship that might change because that would jeopardize the absolute character of marriage. Wilhelm is indeed concerned with the how to love, the how to be married, but it's always an individual how. In contrast, Cavell starts his investigation of marriage from the insight that the relationship of marriage is not in and of itself a given thing. Ever since Luther changed the world by getting married, and Henry VIII changed it again by getting a divorce, Cavell notes, we have had to accept that we do not know what legitimizes neither marriage nor divorce. This is the reason for Cavell's interest in the classical Hollywood comedies, because these films portray couples who consider divorce to be a real possibility and who, because of this, are forced to ask the question of the legitimacy of marriage. In his readings of the remarriage comedies, Cavell deals with a number of central human experiences. These are experiences such as losing one's confidence in one's conception of the world, of not being able to identify one's place herein, of having a fundamental obscurity in one's conception of oneself and one's relation to others. And in the Hollywood comedies, we follow a number of highly privileged, of course, characters who strive to make themselves, their selves, meaningful. Cavell's first point is that the problem these characters face do not arise because of their lack of will. Often they will too much. The problems arise because of a lack of clarity with regard to what they may come to will. Wilhelm's answer to this challenge is to strive to become self by coming to will one's given place in the world, to will the role of husband or wife, for example. But here's Cavell's second point is relevant. It is that the lack of clarity exemplified in these characters is connected to their need to find a place within the social setting that does not offer absolute or even stable roles or institutions. Absolute institutions are not available for them to will. Instead, they face the task of establishing such institutions, such as marriage, in a coming to clarity about what it is that they could will these institutions to be. And finally, given the lack of clarity and of absolute institutions, Cavell's point is that the challenge these characters face, the challenge facing anyone considering marriage, is to come to a clear understanding of how one as a particular person could be understandable within a particular marriage. This is Cavell's, I think, main point, not a question that one can settle alone. It calls for the perspective of and dialogue with someone else, a person who is generally concerned with this question, and to whom one can be said to owe justification, one's lover, one's spouse. Then it's Cavell portrays the only possible legitimization of marriage as the mutual involvement in the process of making this particular marriage understandable, that is, in the mutual striving to become meaningful together. And he says, the legitimacy of marriage arises through the mutual willingness for remarriage, for a sort of continuous reaffirmation that establishes a new reality, not just of the self, but of a fellowship, the reality of this marriage, in Cavell's words, that they exist. What does this have to do with Wittgenstein's view of philosophical activity and his engagement with the reader? Maybe just this, that in Wittgenstein's later writings, we find exactly the attempt to realize this, the reality of a philosophical relationship with the reader, the reality that they exist. Thank you.